Support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Even though Christmas is over, it's still the holiday season, and since the statute of limitations on gift-giving is never over, we thought we'd give you another chance to listen to some of our favorite stories and people from the past year. First up is pun champion Jim Ertner. Last May, Ertner punned his way to the O. Henry Pun Off Championship in Austin, Texas. Ertner joined me in the studio and talked about his championship, which he won on the basis of the applause of the audience rather than the customary groans.
It was. You're quite correct about the groans. In fact, I never have really completely grown up yet.
We got one already in the first answer.
But there was quite an audience reaction to the routine that I did.
Well, I understand that you finished second in the O. Henry Punoff World Championship last year and that you were in a so-called clap-off against the same opponent last year as this year?
Exactly, yes.
And that must have been rather tense.
It was. In fact, last year when we were tied for second, we even talked amongst ourselves and said, well, maybe we should just call it a tie and not go, but they had us do a clap-off there as well.
Mm-hmm.
I succeeded on that one, which was very close to call, but this year it was almost a thunderous response.
A clear win for you.
Yes.
Excellent, excellent. Now, I'm not familiar with punning as a competitive sport. It wasn't just the two of you competing against each other, right? How many punsters were there altogether in Austin?
There were 32 in the competition.
32. Yeah. And how does one qualify?
It's the first 32 people that register for this competition. But it's people who have been doing them before, so they know that this competition is coming up.
And what was the attraction initially for you? What made you want to compete as a punster?
I've been doing it most of my life, and I'll do farewell luncheons, retirement luncheons, but as opposed to doing the typical roast, I'll somehow tie in a string of puns on the particular subject of whoever the person is.
I see. You can sort of do this off the top of your head?
I usually get prepared. I know what the topic is going to be and could give you a sample, for example, of last year's routine.
I'm likely to be sorry that I asked, but can you give our listeners a little sample of the talent for punning that won you the championship?
Last year's was just, in fact, I know this is a sports program. In fact, that was appropriate. You know, this is horse racing time of the year right now, especially with the Triple Crown events. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Kentucky Derby being run just last week. But my mind wanders much further back than that to one of the most famous horse riders of all time, namely Lady Godiva. Now, in her celebrated ride, Lady Godiva didn't win. She didn't place, but she sure did show. That reminds me what happened to Lady Godiva's horse when it noted that she didn't have any clothes on. It made him shy.
Ooh,
or as one non-shy horse said to another one, your pace or mine. Or as another horse said to even another one, I don't remember your mane, but your pace is familiar. I'd like now to try to stir up some interest in horse racing.
Holy cow. Speaking of
horses. But I could go on and on, so.
Please don't. That's magnificent. Yeah. Now, this is stuff that you prepare in advance, or?
This particular competition, the punniest of show, you're limited to 2 minutes, and it's a prepared routine. It can be a long, shaggy dog story, or it can be a routine, or it can be anything you want, as long as it has a pun or puns in it.
Jim Ertner is the 2002 O. Henry Punoff champion and the author of Super Silly Animal Riddles. Jim, thanks for sharing your talent with our Only a Game listeners.
My pleasure, Bill.
You know, we just have a few minutes here, Jim. I wonder if you could take us out with some of your winning puns, the ABC Animal Primer.
All right. Aardvark a million miles if I could only string 26 animal puns together in alphabetical order. I'd badger you and I'd keep carping on the subject until I had no more ideas left. Now, I'd have no egrets as I continue to ferret out more animal puns.
No egrets?
In fact, even gopher broke. Now, some may say this is a harebrained attempt, but I want to tell you, I'm no jackass. And I kid you not, I'm not doing this for a lark. Well, maybe a mite. So please don't nag me. In fact, you ought to try to parrot me. But don't quail from the challenge, because you don't have to be a raccoon tour. So just salmon up some courage and don't take a turn for the worse.
Thank you. You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Only a Game's theme music was composed by Tom Hedden. Our next story takes us to Cambridge, Massachusetts, where a swim meet for the ageless took place this past April.
In the water right now is heat number 12 of the men's 500 freestyle, swimming in lane 1 from Andover YMCA, Fred Myers.
The swimming competition that filled Blodgett Pool at Harvard University last weekend was unusual for a number of reasons. It included almost 700 competitors. It ran pretty much constantly for 3 days and into the nights. And the veterans at this competition were seriously veteran.
The oldest woman swimmer here today is 81 years old. Her name is Billie Ann Burrell. She's from Rhode Island. I'm not sure how old the oldest male swimmer is. I'd have to check on that.
That's Tracy Grilley, a member of the New England Masters Swim Club and also the executive secretary for United States Masters Swimming. She's a valuable resource for anyone looking to learn about this venerable program.
I do know that the oldest master swimmer on record was a man by the name of Tom Lane from San Diego, and he was 102.
102?
102, and he swam. He swam the 50 free and the 100 free, and he also swam the 50 back and 100 back, and when he swam the freestyle, he swam backstroke.
Because he could choose. It was freestyle.
Correct. And backstroke is what he was able to do. He was partially blind.
Remarkable facts. But Tracy Grilley herself was a good deal more representative of the swimmers at the New England Masters Championships, probably the second largest Masters event of the year, than either Ms. Burrow or Mr. Lane. Recovering from shoulder surgery, Grilley maintains that if she could race today against the Tracy Grilley of 25 years ago, today's edition would win.
I'm faster.
You're faster too.
Yep.
Than you were, and you swam competitively in college.
But I was a bum. I swam. I was. I don't know. I swam. I swam for Slippery Rock State College. I swam 3 years. I swam, you know, for the Sea Cone Dolphins down in Rhode Island. But back then it was a little different. You know, when I swam for the Sea Cone Dolphins, you had practice on Thursday night, and you had practice on Saturday, and that was it. And you had 50 kids crammed into a four-lane pool. But I probably could have been much better. But then I also realized that I'm a distance swimmer, whereas when I was at Slippery Rock, I swam other events.
Well, all those,
faster now.
All those qualifications notwithstanding, it must be very satisifying faster. You said you're 40?
I'm 44. 44. Last year at Nationals, I broke a minute for the first time in the 100 free in my life.
The competitive side of master swimming was evident everywhere at the meet. At one point, my conversation with Tracy Grilley was interrupted by another swimmer who inquired about Grilley's time the previous night, smiled, nodded, and walked on. Later that day, they would be racing against each other. But according to Jim Edwards, who will turn 80 a little later on this year, competition is only part of the story.
I don't know a swimmer's in this who isn't very interested in what his time was when he gets through a race. But I would say that competition for almost all of us, probably all of us, is against themselves and the clock and not against individuals. I don't know a single master swimmer who isn't genuinely pleased when someone else does his best time. Not as pleased he is when he does his own best time, but still pleased for other people.
This is not to suggest that swimmers like Edwards, of whom there are not so very many, aren't serious about what they do.
I've kept records of every swimming time I've ever done, and when I see my time in a certain event be about the same as it was 2 years before, that just pleases the hell out of me. And in fact, I was in New Zealand last week, as you may know, swimming in the World's Masters. And in every one of my events, my times were as good as or a shade better than they'd been 2 years ago in the Worlds in Munich.
That's terrific. Did you come home toting more medals than you could carry, or?
No, I could carry them.
For the record, Jim Edwards won 3 events in New Zealand. He matched that performance last weekend at Harvard, leading the 75 to 79 age group in the 500 freestyle, the 1650-meter freestyle, also known as the swimming mile, and the 200-meter backstroke. Tracy Grilley brought home all sorts of hardware in the 40 to 44 division, finishing second in the 200-meter freestyle and third in 3 races, the 50 free, the 1650 free, and the 50 backstroke. All told, the weekend splashing saw 8 U.S. Masters national records fall and the establishment of 104 new New England records. It's 18 minutes past the hour. According to its clients, the Tri Yoga Yoga Center is a serene oasis in noisy London. They value it for the absence of mobile phones and the presence of colored window panes and candles. But according to some of the center's neighbors, the center itself is making too much noise. The sounds of chanting, allegedly relaxing music, and air conditioning units have drawn complaints. According to one employee at the Tri-Yoga Center, there have also been complaints about the racket caused by group breathing, which apparently sounds like a lot of people imitating Darth Vader, and which some citizens have found disruptive, not to mention scary.
If you only knew the power of the dark side.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. To learn more about reports of a successful human cloning experiment and reaction to it, log on to our website, wbur.org, and click on News. We are funded by you, our listeners, and by Direct Tire and Auto Service, featuring Toyo tires for cars, vans, or SUVs. Located in Watertown, Norwood, Peabody, and Natick, directtire.com or 1-800-TIRE-PRO. By WellSpace in Cambridge, celebrating 5 years of natural health at the Fresh Pond Mall in Cambridge, offering corporate and individual holiday gift certificates for massage and more at wellspace.com. And by Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks worldwide for more than 14 years. Details at sophos.com. It's 27 degrees in Boston right now, 25 at Hyannis. The time is 7:20.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, cheer boys and the teams they root for. But first, everybody knows that some sports can be played indoors, but not as many know that some sports are played without getting out of your chair. Last May, Karen Given went to visit the athletes of the CPL, the Cyber Athletes Professional League.
Chill, guys. Don't go in.
This is Counter-Strike, a virtual world where teams of terrorists, played by humans at a computer, run missions, guard hostages, blow up bombs, and each other, while teams of counter-terrorists, also played by humans, try to stop them. Loud gunfire and splashes of blood are common, though at times the violence and mayhem is accompanied by more civilized sounds. Members of Team AP try to safeguard their hostages while a virtual jukebox in the game plays opera. 8 teams are here today to try to qualify for the next round of competition in the Cyber Athlete Professional League. This is the first CPL qualifier for the PC Gaming Arena, a dark storefront crammed with more than 20 computers in a Manchester, Connecticut mall. Qualifiers like this one have been held over the past 3 weekends and will continue through June in more than 30 U.S. cities, as well as South America, South Africa, Yugoslavia, and Australia. And in July, the world's best Counter-Strike teams will meet in Dallas, Texas, for the CPL World Championships. To some, it might seem strange to host an international tournament to determine the world's best computer game team, but not to CPL founder and president Angel Munoz.
We see this as a natural evolution of sports. I know that most people still don't see it that way, but when I envision this, I think 20, 30, 40 years in the future, as the actual games themselves become more involving and become actually, I think at some point they'll be somewhat indistinguishable from reality. I mean, they'll become that real and that much more compelling.
At the CPL's first tournament in 1997, 300 competitors and a handful of spectators showed up. This year, the league is expecting more than 500 competitors and 2,500 spectators in Dallas, and will reach tens of thousands of fans on the internet. The CPL's most successful player is Jonathan Wendell, who's earned more than $100,000 and a new car in tournaments over the past 2 years. Most professional gamers, even the ones who win, earn far less than that. But the hope of winning cash while competing in a game they'd play anyway brought many players to Connecticut's qualifier.
I've been thinking about that all week.
John Kraft is 20 years old. Better known as Acid Frost to his gaming friends, Kraft and his teammates don't have a very good chance of making it to the next level of competition, let alone the finals in July. But that doesn't stop them from dreaming about the $100,000 in cash prize money to be given away in Dallas.
I've been thinking about that for the past, like, 2 or 3 weeks since I signed up. And I paid the $25. It's like, hey, it's a small little investment. It'll pay off for us, possibly. You know, if we win a good $100,000 from $25, that's not bad at all. So.
Players here take the tournament seriously. Many, like Kraft, are smartly dressed in button-down shirts and ties to show off their professionalism. One of the most serious teams at the qualifier is the ECA, or East Coast Alliance.
I know for a fact, FOS, if we play them in this map, they're going to be shooting right across with an op. I know that.
Right here, so
all
I won't come out.
Use that.
The ECA pours over level maps to work out final strategies. At an earlier meeting, they carefully positioned different colored sticky tabs on the maps to indicate the five members of the team and the direction of their fire. Every member of the ECA is wearing a shirt and tie, except Raph, who woke up late and came dressed in a T-shirt and baseball cap. Still, this team seems to know what they're doing.
In position. I got one at the top of the bridge.
In position.
I got two across.
I got
one contact, two. I got one at the top of the door. Roger that.
Copy.
I got two across the bridge.
Roger that.
The ECA takes to the computers for a 15-minute practice round, and things get even more serious. Less experienced teams play the game with their speakers turned all the way up, but members of the ECA wear headsets with microphones so that their opponents can't hear what's going on.
He's across the bridge.
He's across the bridge.
Roger that.
Nading.
Throw a grenade up there. Throw a grenade.
Yeah.
Nice job. Nice.
Developing a well-organized team like this takes a lot of practice, and the ECA takes it seriously. Like most of the players here, they practice almost every day. Renee, a student at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, is no exception. She's the only woman signed up for the tournament, but despite her teammates' promise to let her play as an alternate when the team is ahead, she'll spend most of her day acting as team mascot for Clan FOS. Still, she's not worried about being left out.
I'm not quite as good. I don't spend as much time playing. I try to balance my life, but these kids play 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day. For me, I probably play 6 hours a day or so, which is kind of sad.
And that's balanced.
Between school and hanging out with other friends, I'd say so.
5 seconds, guys. 5 seconds.
After more than an hour of the requisite technical glitches and computer problems, the tournament finally gets underway. Norm, who at 31 is one of today's oldest competitors, explains the game.
There's counter-terrorist force and then there's a terrorist force. The terrorist force either has to blow something up with a bomb or the counter-terrorist has to rescue the hostages from the terrorists.
As players dart down long hallways and sneak around ammunition boxes, it becomes clear that self-preservation is not exactly the point.
It's more important to win the round than it is to survive. Like a good terrorist. To the death.
That level of realism has some worried about the effects Counter-Strike and games like it have on the young people who play them. Earlier this week, a California congressman proposed a bill that would make it illegal in the state to rent or sell games like Counter-Strike to anyone under the age of 17 without parental consent. Representative Joe Baca says he was moved to introduce the bill after an incident late last month when a German high school student shot and killed 16 people and eventually himself in a school rampage. It took just hours for the German media to report that the killer was a fan of computer games and Counter-Strike was his favorite. It's a correlation that has Angel Munoz concerned.
It was incredible to me to see how quickly some reporter found out that he had played a computer game in the past. And so the entire dialogue about that shooting was, again, that game create this terrible reality. What was sort of a side note to it was that this person was a member of two gun clubs. He was a sharpshooter. He had licenses for these weapons and had a history of an unstable personality. And these very important realities became secondary to the fact that he had played a computer game. This is when I feel that the dialogue is misguided.
Still, Munoz says he's not ready to ignore concerns about the effects violent games have on players. He's keeping his eye on studies which have tried to link violent video games to real-world violence, all of which, he says, have been inconclusive. He hopes that encouraging competitors to play on teams in a social environment will mitigate any possible effects of the game. And, he says, he has to rely on parents to do some of the work.
My daughter is 4 and my son is 6 years old, and they're both exposed to the games that we use in the league. And I feel it's my responsibility to educate them about, A, the difference between virtual violence and real violence, and also to make sure that they understand that it's about competition and not about the violence aspect of it.
Yo, move! Yo, George, move! Shoot you.
Despite the constant gunfire, it's hard to imagine anyone at the PC gaming arena becoming a mass murderer. The players here are clean-cut and polite, and the competition is heated but pleasant. Eric, who plays under the name of Druid, is helping to marshal today's tournament. Under CPL rules, he's allowed to disqualify teams who act out, but he can't imagine needing to do that.
We're not punks. We're not like, we don't swear all the time. A lot of us have jobs. I work at Cigna. I mean, we have a lot of people who work like in insurance jobs. I mean, one of the guys here works as an inspector for bombs in an airport. I mean, we're regular guys. We're not any of the like fringe elements of society.
Today's competitors might not be on the fringe of society, but just outside the dark den of the gaming arena, a near perfect New England spring day beckons. By the time the players emerge at closing time tonight, they'll have missed it. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Manchester, Connecticut.
Who says universities need scholarship cheerleaders and musicians to rev up the crowd at football games? At Carleton College in Minnesota, the gender-neutral cheer boys and a pep band that has yet to practice are getting the attention, if not the respect, of fans and players. On October 19th, Mary Stuckey of Minnesota Public Radio watched the winless Carleton Knights take on St. Thomas University. Last month, we aired her audio profile of the hapless football team that could have the worst supporters in the country, or the best, depending on your perspective.
First down, see Thomas.
My name's Dan Farmer. I'm a student at Carleton College. I'm a senior, and I'm the head of the Honkin' Nights Pep Band. I kind of conduct, but it's mostly just dancing and singing and, like, in rhythm. So, yeah, we play music, yeah. We play okay. But,
all right, let's go.
And now, the starting lineups for the men in yellow tights. Woo!
Yeah, yellow tights.
Carleton Knights. Hey! On offense, at quarterback for the Knights is number 5, Ben Cooprider.
Bob Cooprider, our son is Ben, number 5, quarterback. I think it's great. It's so much better than a big, formal, big college band. They have so much enthusiasm. It's fun to see them sit there and just so relaxed and do whatever comes to mind. And then in the second half, they get bored and they're reading. And
well, I'm Steve Stigler. I am indeed a Carleton fan, and I think these guys are tremendous. They're one of the best shows on the field, better than the team at the moment.
My name's Peggy Eichton, and I am supporting Carleton because my son is a freshman player. And I love this band. It brings an era of hope amidst the probability of loss.
Hey, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. Let's go. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. But I'm the instruments.
I'm Judy Lichterman-Munn, class of 74. And I think the Pep Band is fabulous, especially the fact that they don't practice.
There we go.
They have a mind of their own, I tell you. They don't listen to me anymore.
So if you need to reference when I start singing, that means you have to play the instrument. Not necessarily start singing.
I'm Jamie Anthony, and I'm a freshman at Carleton. And they're pretty awesome. I'm glad that we have some spirit, even though the team isn't very good. So the band is why we came.
Hi, I'm Maria Brune, and I'm also a freshman here at Carleton. And I'm kind of used to having a winning football team, and it's not quite so fun if you lose really bad every time. But I don't know, a lot of people are here, so I see. It seems like it's a good time, so.
Our kickoff thing is playing the kazoo progressively louder in the hopes of annoying the other team. Yes?
I thought we did to symbolize the motion of the ball.
I'm Arijit Guha, a senior at Carleton College. I'm a history major and the leader of the Carleton Cheer Boys. We're the gender-neutral cheer boys when we have women cheering with us. But typically it ends up being just a core group of 4 or 5 guys. Well, the first word I'd use is incompetent.
My name is Chris Brand. I'm the head football coach at Carleton College.
What do you think of the cheer boys and the Pep Band? No?
We show up in our bright yellow Carleton t-shirts and any sort of blue pants. We don't really have much of a uniform per se. We originally started out trying to choreograph. Then we realized that none of us have any sort of skills that would be, you know, useful in trying to dance and choreograph. So pretty much we make sure that the Carleton fans are louder than the opposing team's fans. Because a lot of the time what happens is that the Carleton fans will actually be outnumbered by visitors' fans. So we still make that Carleton presence felt. In a school of this size, it's not just these random football players that you don't know, but the people on the football team are your friends, your classmates, the people who live down the hall from you. So, you know, as incompetent as we are and as ridiculous as might seem out there, and the real reason we're out here is just to cheer on our friends and show support for our teammates.
Hey, St. Thomas fans! It's a new half! It's a new game! We got another message for you!
Oompa Loompa Loompa Dee Doo! We are going to dominate you! Woo!
Hey! Answer your walkie-talkie.
Let's go!
I just tried to call you. You were supposed to do the chicken dance.
I love that. All you have to do is first down, Tommy.
Pay attention next time.
Go!
Oh, my good God. So,
Carlton scores first touch on the game. Only in the fourth quarter. The cheer boy just did a lap around the track. And I'm about to die of an asthma attack right now. Oh, wow. And the crowd went crazy. The crowd just went crazy. The final score might not be the greatest, but it was a great game. We had all these fans out here. We had a really fun time in the fourth quarter. We won the fourth quarter 7-0, and the fans were excited all the way throughout. You know what? We come out here to get people excited, to get people in the game, and cheer on our friends. And that's what happened today. So, all in all, it was a good game.
After we aired that story, the Knights finished their season a perfect 0-10. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com, and from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Athens European Bakery. Hand-finished pastries, artisan chocolates, cakes, and gelato for gifts, special occasions, and everyday enjoyment. Athens, 1621 Beacon Street, Brookline. TechFusion.com, 24/7 data recovery specialist, helping businesses and individuals get lost data back and securing existing data from being lost in the future. TechFusion.com, where data is never lost. And by Feynman Remodeling of Arlington, striving to create satisfied clients through innovations in architectural design, craft, and management. Feynman Remodeling on the web at friremodel.org. Good morning. I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, the Celtics lost to the Heat in Miami 90-70 last night. The Bruins lost 5-2 to the Tampa Bay Lightning. The Patriots battle the Miami Dolphins at Gillette Stadium tomorrow. At stake is the AFC East title and a playoff bid. And Pats quarterback Tom Brady finished fourth in the voting for Associated Press Male Athlete of the Year behind Lance Armstrong, Barry Bonds, and Tiger Woods. There are just a few seats left on our next Citizens of the World tour to Vietnam with Jackie Leighton this spring. Don't miss out on this unique opportunity. Call 1-800-909-9287. In the forecast, mostly cloudy skies today, highs in the 30s, tonight lows in the 20s. Tomorrow, partly sunny, a chance of sprinkles in the afternoon. It will be brisk, highs in the 30s.
Political humorist Jimmy Tingle's latest one-man show, Jimmy Tingle in the Promised Land, is now enjoying an extended run. See an exclusive benefit performance for WBUR on January 5th at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater in Davis Square, Somerville. General admission tickets get you into the show, and with VIP tickets, you can also join Jimmy at a post-show party at Redbones in Davis Square. Call 617-591-1616 or log on to WBUR.org.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, tools, racing, and lots of beer. But first, in the introduction to her book about her relationship to horse racing and the track, Nan Mooney writes, "Racing's not about what you expect. It's about letting go expectations, taking a gamble. How else could you possibly fall in love?" The book is My Racing Heart, subtitled The Passionate World of Thoroughbreds and the Track. Nan Mooney joined me this past July and talked with me about how her grandmother used the track to teach Nan about other things besides racing.
She really did. She was quite an unconventional woman and a real adventurer. Spent time as a fur trapper, taking pack trips into the glaciers in Alaska. And she grew up basically at the turn of the century. She was born in 1889. So she was always looking for ways to exercise that unconventional bone. And the racetrack had really given that to her. And I think she felt it was really important that I have something that could give that to me, because I was from the beginning sort of a rebellious child as well, and I think she it was important to her that I find somewhere to channel that kind of energy. And so she chose the racetrack as a place that could teach me a lot about the pluses and minuses of life and how people and horses and societies and everything operate.
At one point in my racing heart, you introduce your reader to Cleavey, who's a groom thoroughly dedicated to the horses in his charge, and you say of him, "Those horses have a way of filling you. Anything else becomes just pocket change." But you did not fall into the daily work of the track yourself. Why was that?
I didn't. I think in a way I was almost spoiled growing up as nothing more than a fan. I always got to have the racetrack on my terms, and I could move through. I could spend time in the mornings watching the horses work out. I could be there in the afternoons. I could bet or not bet. I could be there every day for weeks, and then I could disappear for months. And it could feed my passion exactly how I wanted it to. And I think I wanted to keep it that way.
It's interesting because you worry at one point when you realize you're not going to be connected to the track except as a fan, you're worried that you've let your grandmother down.
Growing up, I was always sure that I would do something involved with the track. I wanted to be a jockey for a long time, or until it became apparent I was going to turn out to be 5'11", which doesn't really work in that profession.
No.
I just assumed that Maymay, my grandmother, was grooming me for some sort of job at the racetrack. It had never occurred to me till I went to her that she had never had any sort of job at the racetrack, that she was just a fan. And so, of course, when I went to her and said, "Well, I don't think I want to do anything at the racetrack. I think I just want it to be my sport that I love." And she said, "Well, of course. What else would it be?"
She knew all along.
Wise woman, yes.
You come to especially admire several people connected to the track. One is the magnificently successful former jockey, Angel Cordero, who, besides winning a great deal, was also accused of fixing races. Was the possible dark side part of the attraction here?
Oh, without question. I mean, I think anything that's at all interesting has an underbelly to it, and the racetrack is no exception. People take huge risks there, and they're not always wise ones, but I think that's the way you should live your life, and that's part of the excitement. You really don't know what's happening, and fortunes can turn on a dime, and it's just a lot of guesswork and possibility, and that's the charm of the track.
Inevitably, the matter of betting on the horses does enter this chronicle of the track and your relationship to it. You write about a gambler named Albert who, and I'm quoting again, "was so immersed in playing the horses that it dyed his skin and slopped into his eyeballs, affecting the very way he thought and moved." Albert really taught you, after a fairly long association, that you couldn't relate to the track as he did.
He did. Albert actually taught me a lot about the racetrack. I mean, he spent his lifetime. He had charts and index cards and books on animal psychology, and he knew everything about every trainer and every horse who's, you know, what their grandmother had done. And he knew everything. There was no time in his life for anything else. And again, I realized that the gambling doesn't pull me that way. I need the whole picture. I'm just as drawn by the horses and the personalities. And yeah, I bet. But to do that to the exclusion of everything else, that was not my relationship to the racetrack. That was his.
Albert and others acknowledged, though, that you had a sense. The horses kind of spoke to you. The winner in particular would sometimes almost wink at you before a race.
Yeah, emphasis on the sometimes. But again, I think that's something my grandmother taught me to be able to pick up. I think the horses send signals when you go and look at them before the races. They send signals whether they're ready to run or not. And, you know, you're looking for ears that are perked up and sort of a little sidestepping trot and just the horses that look full of themselves and have a lot of energy. And occasionally you see it and it's just obvious. A horse is glowing in the paddock and you got to bet on those horses and they do win.
Thoroughbred horses are fragile animals, and in one of the most powerful passages in the book, you write about the consequence of that fact. Could you read from the second paragraph on page 179, Nan?
Sure.
It was a sprint race, just 5 furlongs. My filly broke at the front of the pack and stayed there, gliding along like a gift and leaving all the other horses strung out behind. Then, as she swung around the turn and came to the head of the lane, something happened. Something too tiny to spot, one heel clipping another, a glitch in the track, or maybe nothing at all. And she dropped to her knees right there in the middle of the home stretch. Somehow, all the other horses kept going, parting like water around a rock. My filly froze on her twin kneecaps, as if in prayer, as if she knew what would happen when she tried to stand again and was putting it off as long as possible. Finally, she rose on 3 strong, steady legs. She tried a step on the 4th and rocked back in surprise. The hoof wouldn't meet the ground. Instead, it dangled from her shin with the skin and flesh broken away, and the end of a bone jutting out snapped clean in half. Since I couldn't bear to keep looking at her, I turned toward the people around me. They were all doing the same, swiveling their necks, shaking their heads, imprinting something they wished they could erase. I glanced back toward the track. The filly took a stumbling step or two, as if expecting her other leg to reappear. Then she stopped moving entirely. She didn't look panicked, only bewildered, and maybe a little bit betrayed. "She's a goner," mumbled an old man next to me. Then he made the sign of a cross, and though I hadn't been inside a church since 6th grade, I crossed myself too.
Following that description, you write, "Staying with the racetrack means slipping away from black and white and residing in various shades of gray. It isn't about the nature of the track, it's about the nature of love." That's only 2/3 of the way through the book. I wonder a little how you found that there was anything more left to write.
Well, my relationship, as that says, my relationship with the track is very complex. And honestly, that horses break down is not something I've come to a happy peace with. I don't have the feeling that, oh, well, that happens and you move on. It's incredibly upsetting every time you see it. But the things that draw me are still there and they haven't changed. And I suppose you just find a way to live with it. The horses love to run. The people do everything they can to make sure the horses don't break down. And for me, that's enough to keep going.
Nan Mooney, who writes for The Blood Horse, the journal of record for thoroughbred horse racing, is the author of My Racing Heart, published by HarperCollins. Nan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much, Bill. This was great.
Say a prayer for the cowgirl. Her horse ran away.
In the past, only a game has featured such esoteric sports as skillet tossing, wife carrying, and ice golf. In honor of this great only a game tradition, and with the help of our intrepid reporter Sean Tooltime Cole, in April, we brought you Belt Sander Racing.
2 by 2, they come screaming down the 85-foot-long, waist-high wooden track, trailing rooster tails of sawdust and long yellow extension cords that power them to the finish line. 21 contestants are racing their belt sanders in today's event, delighting hundreds of spectators crowded into a dusty workshop at Kenyon Woodworking in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. At the end of the day, 11 of them will walk away with trophies, 3 in the stock class for machines raced right out of the box, 3 in the modified class for souped-up sanders, and 5 consolation prizes, including best-dressed belt sander. Some of these machines can zip from start to finish in less than 3 seconds. A few never see the finish line at all. So why would someone want to crash a fairly expensive piece of woodworking equipment into a spring-loaded bale of styrofoam at 65 miles an hour?
It's goofy.
Dave Kenyon is co-owner of Kenyon Woodworking and one of the organizers of the race.
You know, it's obviously tongue-in-cheek, and at the same time, it's deadly serious. So it's really got it all. I mean, as opposed to the Super Bowl, which is strictly tongue-in-cheek, you know.
Kenyon's office is filled with mementos of races past. One shelf is lined with trophies from events he's won, some crowned with miniature cast-iron models of belt sanders. Kenyon says the history of belt sander racing in his shop stretches all the way back to the 1988 Olympics.
We were sitting around. My guess is we probably had a couple of beers, and of course we thought it wasn't fair that there wasn't an Olympics for cabinet makers, and we thought, well, you know, what are we going to do about that? And, you know, just one thing leads to another, and next thing you know, we're racing belt sanders. We figured that was our equivalent of an Olympic sport. I'm pretty sure that's how it got started, but I couldn't tell you for sure.
Out of that first contest was born a loosely knit group of racers called NEBSRA, the New England Belt Sander Racing Association. For 5 or 6 years, they held races every Halloween and Mother's Day. These days, the events are less frequent. This year's race is the first one in 2 years. But Kenyon says NEBSRA isn't the only organization that races belt sanders. There's also NUBSRA, the National Belt Sander Racing Association, a group that set a world record by jumping 6 motorcycles with a belt sander.
What amazes me is that guys would let their Harleys be jumped by a belt sander. I'm sure there's beer involved there.
And then there's CUMPTRA, the Central Maine Power Tool Racing Association. Kenyon says these racers are fiercely competitive and often walk away with trophies from NEBSRA events. And then there's IBDA, the International Belt Sander Drag Racing Association.
I'm guessing there's a couple of Canadians who race or something like that.
According to Kenyon, IBDA has crassly commercialized the sport of belt sander racing, doing promotional events at hardware stores. He says for him, racing belt sanders is a much more personal affair than that, something to be shared privately among friends.
It's a real family event. It's a family event with beer, you know.
You keep mentioning the beer.
The beer is central, pretty much. Without beer, I don't think you'd have belt sander racing. In fact, without beer, I'm sure there wouldn't be belt sander racing.
Hey, how are you? Good to see you. Pretty good. How are you doing?
About an hour before the race, the contestants are putting the finishing touches on their sanders and helping themselves to free beer as the crowd drifts in. Most of the racers have decorated their machines to the hilt and given them names to match. There's Marie's purple obsession.
How could I describe it? Well, it's purple with glitter.
One contestant has glued toy hockey sticks to either side of his sander to keep it from grinding to a halt on the rails. He's also topped the machine with his son's Boston Bruins helmet and painted a number 16 on the side.
Hey, what's his name, Tyler?
Derek Sanderson.
Derek Sanderson. Get it?
Some of the sanders look more like miniature floats than power tools. One of them is flanked on either side with huge cardboard Enron logos. In the middle, on a bed of shredded paper, sits a cowboy doll with George Bush's face. And when you press little George's tummy, he speaks.
It's play time! Put her there, partner.
Another one.
I always look out for a friend. You're my favorite deputy.
Dave Kenyon's sander, Custom Deluxe, is one of the more subdued entries of the bunch, although he has decided at the last minute to glue 2 round, bulbous wooden objects to the front, much to his 14-year-old son Henry's chagrin.
Don't you think it's more streamlined this way?
It has boobs.
I don't think of them as boobs. I think of them as aerodynamic cowling.
Kenyon hopes the aerodynamic cowlings will intimidate the competition, particularly the guys from the Central Maine Power Tool Racing Association, known for their speedy sanders. CUMPTRA founder Terry Robinson is racing one of the fastest sanders of the day, Mad Max. With beer on his breath, he tells me his machine once appeared in Easy Rider magazine.
To be honest, years ago, I've been racing for 15 years. And many years ago, we went to the Triple R Bar in Bath, Maine. Easy Rider magazine was coming. You want to make an appearance, you know? You want them to notice you. So I named my sander Mad Max, and it stuck ever since.
And what drew you to it in the first place?
Racing belt sanders?
Yeah.
I ride a motorcycle in the summer, and in the wintertime I can't go. You got to have something to do. And racing belt sanders, you can hold a beer in one hand.
As opposed to racing motorcycles.
Yeah, well, you can't hold a beer.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the first race. We have Derek Sanderson and Smitty. All righty, let's hear it. Okay.
Each race is run in 3 heats. You have to win 2 to move on to the next round. Before each heat, the racers stand with their thumbs poised on remote switches, waiting for MC Huck Davies to start the Christmas tree, a set of 6 lights that blinks red down to green.
The tree is live.
The races last all afternoon and into the evening. Some of the racers clearly want nothing more than to win. Others are more interested in showing off their ornately decorated sanders. At the end of the first modified round, it's time for Dave Kenyon's Custom Deluxe to prove its mettle. Like a young Dale Earnhardt Jr., following in his father's footsteps, Dave's son Henry picks up the switch and takes the driver's position.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, watch your ears, watch your feet, and watch the track. Racers ready? Tree is live. Whoa. All right, let's hear it. That was beautiful.
Henry wins the race handily, dominating the first 2 heats. Still, his dad is worried that the competition might be too stiff for the young racer. So before the finals, he takes Henry aside to give him a little fatherly advice.
Dad, we're flashing.
When you get down to the finals...
Dad, we're flashing.
That's okay. Listen to me now. Son, listen to me.
Yeah?
When you get down to the finals, you're going to probably be up against Mad Max. Okay? I want you to make sure he sees the aerodynamic cowlings. If he's looking at the aerodynamic cowlings, when the Christmas tree goes down, you can get a jump on him.
But even the aerodynamic cowlings aren't enough to intimidate the racers from Maine. In the end, Terry Robinson's sander Mad Max finishes second in the modified class. Another Maine sander called Potential Disaster finishes third. And Dave and Henry's Custom Deluxe comes in fourth, a placement for which there is no trophy. After the race, Dave Kenyon leans against the wall in the corner of the room and explains his failed strategy to the MC's wife, Ann Davies.
Well, next year.
He was too strong.
It was always next year.
There's always next year or next decade or who knows when. Whatever the spirit moves us.
For Only a Game, I'm Sean Cole in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts.
The tree is live. We're open. Let's go.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical consultant is Tad Curry. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from former technical director Tad Curry, who is learning what life is like without Only a Game.
Could you please sign this, Mr. Sandberg? Ooh, Ron Santo!
Oops, it's the first time he's slept on a Saturday in over 2 years. Better just let him rest. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Santo.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR. This is WBUR.